reflect the geographic diversity of the state, and at least one member needs to be an elected official at the time of appointment. And they've got pretty significant powers. They make rules, which includes administrative rules and statewide planning goals. I want to stress to you that statewide planning goals are just that. They are administrative rules. Sure, there is a special process for adopting, amending, and repealing them, but they are administrative rules that you, as the legislature, could do whatever you want with, because you have the legislative authority to go above them, go below them, do whatever it needs to do to fix them should you determine they are not properly working to reflect the policy decisions of the state. LCDC also acknowledges and periodically reviews comprehensive plans. They are the clearing station for grants to local governments for planning. And they also file appeals of local land use decisions to LUBA when they feel that the local decision violates a statewide planning goal. And Chair Close asked that question to the director respecting one of those appeals that they did recently file from the Morrow County. That was a decision made by Morrow County that LCDC appealed up to LUBA. The status of that case right now, I believe, is the LUBA appeal was stayed pending negotiations between the parties. So it's kind of in abeyance, as far as I know. Okay, the statewide planning goals, again, they're administrative rules that have a special process for adoption and modification. You can modify or overturn any goal or any interpretation of any goal, and there's 19 of them. And they deal with many different topics, including protection for farm and forest land, economic development, housing, and urbanization. A lot of people that I talk to don't know that there is a economic development statewide planning goal. There is. Goal 9 is the economic development goal, and there are administrative rules that were adopted pursuant to that goal. But I attended the same conference that Chair Ferrioli attended yesterday, and one of the speakers made the remark that all goals are equal, but some goals are more equal than others. Some good Orwellian terminology, and I would have to agree that that has been the case with respect to Goal 9, economic development. There is an exception process. You hear about that every time somebody tries to do something because they feel a goal is having detrimental impact on their community. They march in with a bill that would overturn that goal, and the department comes in and tells you that they just need to take an exception to that goal. There is a process, but it is very difficult to obtain an exception. The three ways you can obtain an exception are listed. It's got to be physically developed, irrevocably committed, or a reasons exception. They're very difficult to obtain. I don't spend much time on it with my members because usually it's not going to happen. Urban area planning. This is what zoning had historically been about across the country, separating conflicting uses from one another. The thought was that you did not want to site a factory in a residential zone. You did not want to put a school near a conflicting use, you know, a butcher's shop or something. And that's what zoning had always been about. Except in Oregon, we created a new aspect of urban area planning, and that was Goal 14, which created the issue of the size and locations of urban growth boundaries. Now, we've institutionalized the idea of an urban growth boundary here because we've had them for so long, but most places do not have UGBs. There are other states that have moved in that direction. Washington now has a similar concept. Florida has a similar concept, but the majority of the states in the United States of America do not have urban growth boundaries. So it is something that originated here, and you heard the director call it a hallmark of Oregon's planning system. I would agree. It is something that was created here, and you know, so it's worked in some situations. It's not worked in others, but it is something that is unique. I want you to appreciate that. But what happens when you create and amend UGBs is you create a very political and contentious process. I'm sure all of you know that the metro regional government in Portland just voted to amend its urban growth boundary, the largest expansion in the history of that urban growth boundary, and we expect there to be many appeals. We expect that process to go on for the next probably 5 years before we know for sure where that UGB is actually going to be, where the amendment is actually going to stick. It's a very contentious process. A lot of work for lawyers, a lot of billable hours up there for a lot of different lawyers that are going to be sharpening their knives as we speak, ready to file their appeals. The goal of the UGB is to divide up urban lands from rural lands. And all cities are required to have UGBs that contain a sufficient amount of land to accommodate long-range growth, need for housing, employment, and livability. Livability is a term that I put in quotes because if you put 100 people in the room together, you get 100 different definitions of livability. So that's a great term for lawyers that like to litigate. But one thing about urban growth boundaries that is in the statute, and you mentioned this the director, with Paul Kircher, was ORS 197.298. That is the statute that gives the priority of land to be added to urban growth boundaries. And you have been very clear as to what land can come in first. And you have said that exception land, land that has received exceptions to the goals to protect farm and forest land, have to be considered first before you can move on to more valuable lands, to more resource lands. And then they divide up resource lands depending on soil classifications, with the highest class soils being the last lands that can be considered. Now, LCDC has adopted a rule called the Subregional Needs Rule that right now applies only to Metro. But if Metro implements that rule through their regional framework plan, and they have said that they want to, that would allow them to do a subregional analysis so that if there was a subregional need in a place like Hillsborough for a specific type of land, they would not need to use land on the other side, say in Damascus, to fill the need for Hillsborough. This process has just barely begun. I think it's permissible under the statute. Other parties do not. This is another thing that's probably going to end up in the courts. I do commend LCDC for writing the rule and giving Metro this ability. Metro has asked for this ability for several years now. Because, remember, with Metro, you're dealing with a huge geographic area. The size of the Metro Urban Growth Boundary, I believe, is about 300 square miles. It's huge. So it's, you know, there's conditions that are site-specific that need to be looked at on a sub-regional basis. And if we're talking about a statewide planning system that gives equal weight to the goals, you would think it's only logical, because one of the goals is to reduce vehicle miles traveled. But to put housing in a place like Damascus for people that have jobs in Hillsborough, you're going to be doubling, tripling, quadrupling the vehicle miles traveled on already congested roadways. So we testified in support of this administrative rule and helped Metro get it through the rulemaking process. Okay, the Metro region and other cities, other large cities of greater than 25,000 population, also require a 20-year supply of buildable land. That was a bill that passed in 1995. You have defined in the statutes buildable land as meaning residential land. But the lack of industrial commercial land has really hurt Oregon, because there is in the Goal 9 rule a requirement that there be a 20-year supply of industrial commercial land, but the needs are different for commercial industrial land, and you heard the director talk about shovel-ready sites. That's what we need in Oregon. We don't have very many of them. We are driving employers to other states because other states have them and we don't. One of these conferences that I attended with my counterparts from other state, I had my counterpart from Arizona come up to me and thank me for Oregon's land use system because it's created so many jobs for the people of Arizona with sites that were unable to be located here that ended up in Phoenix. Yesterday at...
Madam Chair?
Senator Shields?
Harlan, you and I have talked many times, and I've heard that anecdote before. If we're going to move ahead in what the governor obviously has cited as economic development as a top priority, can we take it from the anecdotal level to getting, you know, specific? I mean, it'd be very difficult to do. I mean, the guy in Arizona, for instance, has this feeling, and maybe he had two or three indications where industries moved from, or that were thinking of siting, you know, in Oregon went to Arizona. But there may have been multiple reasons, and might have had more than just our land use. Maybe it was other things. Maybe they got some tax incentives or something in Arizona that we wouldn't give them here or whatever. Is there some way of actually finding statistical or, you know, some concrete data that would support, you know, this last bullet? I would like to do that. I think it's worth a discussion because we're talking seriously about jobs, and I certainly want jobs for my Senate district, which is the I-205 corridor between the airport and Clackamas County. How do you do that?
Co-Chair Ferrioli, Co-Chair Close, Senator Shields, you actually asked for a study in the last session. House Bill 3557 created a task force to study this very issue, and the task force was made up of certified smart guys, economists, local government.
That was probably in the statute. They have to be certified smart guys.
Local government types, economic development types, some of the lobby, the Thousand Friends were represented, and they have actually produced a report showing the problems, the intrinsic problems in Oregon just for this very issue. And they should be bringing forward some legislation for your consideration in this session that would deal with this.
You should get to see the report, Madam Chair.
Yeah, good point. We will check with Judith on that.
You should talk. This was a commission that was chaired by the director of the LCB and the director of economic development. And they worked throughout the year on producing this. It's a pretty voluminous report, but they did make some very eye-opening findings.
Is there a summary to it?
Yes, there is an executive summary.
That's something maybe Senator Shields could ask you to mail to each of you, since we don't have another committee meeting.
And this, you know, this goes back to the reasons why we created Senate Bill 100 in the first place. Remember, farming and forestry was looked at as an industry. So there needed to be lands, there needed to be protections for those lands because of the jobs created by that industry. Well, right now, high tech is our single largest industry with the most jobs associated with it, and yet there is not a single thing in the statewide planning goals that deal with protecting land for high tech. These large-scale industrial sites that are needed to create these jobs that you need, because those are the jobs that are producing the income to fund the programs in the schools that, you know, the budget situation is about today. I just give you another example, another anecdote, Senator. Applied Materials wanted to site a manufacturing facility out in Hillsboro near Intel, its biggest customer. They needed 100 acres, and they couldn't find it. And they really wanted a site there. I had a good discussion with the Hillsboro Economic Development Director, and this was a company that wanted to do anything it could to site out there, but eventually, they just threw in the towel, and now this company is in Austin, Texas, and it created all those jobs for the people of Texas. Okay, rural planning. There really isn't much planning going on outside of urban growth boundaries. You have rural areas divided up in resource land or exception land. And I took these percentages from the department's 2001 Farm Forest Report. I've seen other people say that the amount of resource land is 97% versus 3%. I think 91%, you get the picture. There's a lot of land out there. The vast majority of privately held property outside of UGBs is zoned for resource use. And when we say that we're planning for it, all that we're really doing is we're finding exceptions to those farm and forest uses. Now, secondary lands issue. I did prepare a little bit on secondary lands because I thought that you would go into it with the director. This is an issue respecting land that is zoned for resource use, but really cannot be put to resource use. So of this 91% of private land that we're talking about, it's all protected from conflicting uses. But in reality, most of it cannot be put to beneficial farm and forest use. So what really happens is the land sits vacant and unused, and it contributes next to nothing to the economy and to the state income tax coffers. Cannot be used to create jobs, cannot be used for rural home sites, and most importantly, cannot be leveraged adequately to create the capital that would be put back into the state's economy. And I give you statistics. 16 million acres are zoned exclusive farm use. But what we're really talking about is only about 2 million acres that are prime productive farmland. So that is 14 million acres of dead capital. And I use that term because I just happened to read a book recently by a Peruvian economist, Hernando de Soto, and his big thesis of why the third, and this was a macroeconomic theory book, but his big theory about why the third world stays poor is because so much of their land is dead capital. They cannot put it to beneficial use. Whereas in the Western world, in Europe and the United States, we've been able to put our land to beneficial use. We allow people to build a home and then take out a mortgage on their home and put that money back into the economy and build a business and do entrepreneurial things with that money. And that contributes to the economy and that contributes to the state tax coffers. But yet, what we do in Oregon is directly opposite that. We tie this land up and it's dead capital. It sits there, it's in farm deferral, so the property taxes aren't even coming in to the counties, and there are no income taxes being generated for you. So I don't want to harp on it too much, but you need to think about that. When we talk about economic development and we talk about some changes that need to be made to the way we do business in Oregon, this is something that we are going to want to talk about. We're going to bring forward some legislation that we hope you will favorably consider on this very issue.
Yeah, Chairman.
Senator Ferriero.
There is a disconnect, I think, between the intention of protecting high-value farmland and the effect that I see in the rural districts that I represent. But I think I would be remiss if I didn't offer a mitigating view, and that is that ranchers and farmers will tell you that they have capitalized their holdings, because they do have mortgages, they do have loans, they do have operating capital dollars available. There is a real argument that I think needs to be the focus of this discussion, and that is, one is, what is the highest and best use of the land? Two, what is the soil quality and productive capacity of the land? And three, what are the current and proposed uses of that land? And those things are the things that you never get to. You know, if you get to the minimum parcel size argument and you have to stop there, then it doesn't really, you know, the community interest and the individual desire and purpose never really get considered. You know, we have some exceptions that we've had to write into the rule, and that seems to many people like an erosion of protections for high-value farmland. We've got a lot of ranchers and farmers that are grazing on land that is so marginal in value, you would wonder if it really is even economically efficient to operate grazing opportunities. Yet dryland grazing is the feature in the east side of the state of Oregon, and so is dryland cropping. So I guess I want to say that you're framing the argument in a way that I think is very beneficial. Soil type is an issue that we haven't really considered. Highest and best use is not an issue that we've been discussing in connection with this issue. But the highest and best use may be as much in the eye of the beholder or the landowner as it is in anybody's vision, and that's the thing that we haven't captured. So I'm pleased that you brought this issue up, but I would just tell you that there's a lot of dimension to this issue that I hope we get an opportunity to go into that dimension, because I think it's going to change some directions in our land use plans, and I think it's time that we did that.
Thank you, Chair Ferrelli.
I appreciate it. I guess I just, you know, the idea is that you're framing an issue, we know, we have an idea of where we are. There's excellent documentation for lack of opportunity and opportunities foreclosed and foregone, especially in rural communities, especially in these economic times. But there's a countervailing argument that these protections are not all gratuitous either. So it's the balance point that we're missing. That's the thing I think we need to get at.
Chair Close, Chair Ferrelli, we just want to have the discussion for so long. I mean, the discussion hasn't even been allowed to take place in this chamber. And we think that, you know, now is the time. I mean, the state has found itself in a dire economic situation. Let's put everything on the table and revisit some of these issues that people have been unwilling to go into for all these years.
And Madam Chairman, I guess just let me give you an illustration quickly of the kind of dimension I'm referring to. One of the fastest growing land use trends in eastern Oregon is hunting reserves, fee hunting reserves. And the potential for income is great. But when you compare fee hunting, which produces quite a bit of income for the owner, with cattle ranching, which produces a value-added commodity that other potential added value processors can be introduced to, then the relative value of the cattle ranch in terms of the community benefit may be higher than the relative value of a fee hunting ranch. But we see a lot of conversion because fee hunting depends on no development, on unused land, and it's independent of soil types or some other things. You just have to have good bird habitat, primarily, is what I see. And I think the issue of whether or not ranching is still viable and other agricultural uses of land is still viable depends as much now on the ability to build on and live on and work the land as it does any other thing. And it's almost impossible for people to start small and scale up in an agricultural operation today because they can't live on the land that they're trying to manage. That's a problem. But thank you, Madam Chairman. I think this is a very complicated issue. It's going to take a lot of discussion, but I think it's overdue.
Thank you.
Harlan, I'm going to give you about 7 more minutes, and then we have to go to the Salmon Recovery Task Force report. So
I'm almost done.
I'm going to ask the committee to hold your questions, and we'll try to keep you on target for lunch.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. All right, rural exception lands, those are the other 9% of the lands that we're talking about outside of UGBs. Even rural exception lands are not being allowed to be planned properly. And you have a situation in 1986 where the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that Goal 14 applies both inside as well as outside of UGBs, and therefore there could be no, quote, urban uses on rural exception lands. And LCDC has used this case to force counties to disallow beneficial uses on many of these rural exception lands. And I give you an example in my next slide. Administrative rules that prohibit commercial and industrial uses outside UGBs and any buildings that exceed certain square footage requirements. They will not allow you to do a commercial use outside of a UGB in a building of more than 3,000 square feet, believe it or not. Lane County just had its comprehensive plan and periodic review and found themselves being forced to adopt very restrictive rural industrial, rural commercial zoning. Klamath County finds itself in that situation as we speak right now. And most of the other rural counties around the state, if they haven't been forced to do it already, will be forced to do it. This is through the unincorporated communities rule. I've listed the citation for you. I encourage you to take a look at it. This is statewide zoning. That's what it is. This is LCDC saying that we think that a commercial use of more than 3,000 square feet, no matter where it is, no matter what county it's located in, no matter, we don't care about the site-specific conditions. It's an urban use. It's not permitted by Goal 14, period.
Madam Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Would that exclude potato sheds?
Sorry?
Would that exclude building of large potato sheds then?
Co-Chair Ferrioli, Co-Chair Close, Representative Jensen, it depends if the potato shed is a permitted use under, you know, it depends whether or not it's defined as an industrial or commercial use. I don't know, it could be defined as an ag use. It's possible. I would encourage you to talk to your local planning department. Another example of where LCDC has substituted its judgment for that of a local county, again, comes out of Klamath County, where Klamath County had attempted to rezone 20-acre non-resource lands to 5-acre rural residential lands, so they would allow home sites one lot per 5 acres, definitely not what I consider urban sprawl. And that case was appealed by the department three times until eventually LUBA decided that LCDC, you lose. And the developer and the county prevailed after spending 3 years in litigation and I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars. And that brings me to my last little slide for you, a query with respect to the racetrack that co-chair Close brought up earlier. Does a $500 million project that consists of a NASCAR-style speedway and a hotel violate Goal 14? Does it matter the project will create hundreds of permanent new jobs and become the single largest tax-paying entity in that county? Does it matter if out-of-state investors get the wrong idea? Picture yourself an investor in Chicago that has said you'll give $2 million to this project out there in Oregon because your market guys have told you that this thing is going to pencil out. And you get it through the local process. They spent about $450,000 on lawyers, consultants, and traffic engineers to make this thing work. And they got it through. They spent years getting it through. Personally, I thought it was pie in the sky when I first heard about this, but they managed to get it through. The economic development people out at the Poro Moro should be commended because they've done remarkable things out there, as I'm sure you know, Representative Jensen. And they got this thing through, and it was the state of Oregon that appealed it. So next time you're that investor in Chicago, are you going to think twice about dumping your $2 million investment for a project out there in Oregon? Brings me to my conclusion. It's really time for you to take an honest look at this 30-year land use system we have in Oregon. You need to start asking critical questions. What do we value here? Do we value our jobs and our schools and our local economies? And most importantly, are the economic considerations that caused us to begin this experiment 30 years ago the same today as they were back then? With that, I conclude my presentation. Be happy to answer any additional questions you might have. And thank you very much for inviting me here today.
Very excellent presentation. Thank you so much. I'm sure that educated us a great deal. Specific questions? You know, at some point I'd like to see, you know, acres zoned, how much, which soil type, you know, those kind of breakdown of figures. Is that something that you have?
We would like to see more of the control brought back to the counties. I mean, what has happened is LCDC, through their administrative rulemaking process, has taken power away over and over again. And local planners find themselves unable to do things that would be in the best interest of their communities. They just can't get there because they're in periodic review and they just, the department will not let them do it. And they're forced to either, you know, fight LCDC or to capitulate.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Committee, our last item before lunch is the Salmon Recovery Task Force report. And Ed is here. Is John Platt here?
Mm-hmm.
Ed, would you please come forward?
Which one?
Which one?
Oh, that'd be good.
While the gentlemen are getting ready, we're going to have a 5-minute recess. We have sound system problems again. So please just.